maybe I won't ever be a part of the elite, or maybe I won't ever be like a part of like the fastest group, but that's not going to stop me from training like I want to be there.
Welcome to the Zero Quit Podcast, where I bring you candid conversations with elite athletes, entrepreneurs, specialists, and other creatives. I'm your host, Brock Covington, and through these dialogues, you will hear powerful stories and practical advice that will help you live a more active and intentional life. If you enjoy the show, be sure to subscribe and share it with a friend.
I was literally going to say that, like, maybe you're the person in the sport who actually enjoys it more because you aren't necessarily going in to be top five, top 10. And now suddenly you get to go out there and like truly just have fun. Not to say that I'm not having fun when I'm out there, but like races go by so fast to me because I'm constantly like strategizing. Where am I at? Who's behind me? Who's in front of me? It's like a game out there for me.
Well, and that way, maybe it's like more distracting when you have those like markers.
Way more distracting. I just did a little half like a month ago. A half is decently short compared to what we've done, right? Yeah. But it felt like it was over in a blink of an eye because it was such a fast race. And I was like racing in the third position the whole time. Yeah. And it was just like, it was crazy.
Well, that's one thing too I've talked to competitive runners like Don, where he's happy to go into a race every once in a while where he's not trying to place, mainly because when you're in that mode of thought and of racing, you don't appreciate the scenery in the race as much. So then like you reflect back, you're like, okay, I guess I do remember that. Because it reminds me, in a much lesser non-race situation, Maddie, my wife, loves like hiking and outdoors, but her version or definition of hiking is different than mine.
Okay.
Mine is like, oh, this is like an 8-mile hike. Let's, you know, do a slight easy jog out there and put a little bit of pace and get to a cool spot and look out. Hers is like, let's just kind of lollygag out there and enjoy the, you know, the roses and the daisies and like stop and look out. And there's no urgency to it. Yeah. More so in my perspective is, oh, well, if we at least run a bit of it, we can kind of get past any boring sections and we can, in the same 2 hours, we could traverse like 12 miles or something.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, we're not hiking together.
See, I relate, like, I don't really like hiking.
Yeah.
Like, I don't, like, I had a friend come visit from Georgia.
Yeah.
And we did like an 8-mile hike. And by the last 3 miles, I kid you not, I was walking as fast as I could without making it look like I was trying to trot because I was bored. I truly was impatient.
I'm the same way. And it's not from a lack of appreciation of the outdoors, because I'm sure like you, I love the scenery in the outdoors. It's more so I just can get more out of nature when I'm interacting with it more intensely.
Yeah.
And when I can see more of it in like the same amount of time.
Yeah, yeah, same. And but it's also for me, it's like, okay, if I'm gonna be moving, I want the movement to be more intentional. Just I can walk in a King Soopers. Like that's the way I look at it.
Yeah, imagine the views are different, but the experience might be similar.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, usually I just kick off with an introduction, but this is a good way to include all of this. Today on the Zero Quit Podcast, I have Reagan Sykes. She's an ultra runner and hybrid athlete based here in Colorado Springs. Fortunately, can have her here in person. And while balancing strength and endurance, she runs a bunch of races throughout the year. Specifically, and recently, she ran her first 100-mile here over the summer at the Run Rabbit Run 100. So now we're here chatting, catching up. The first thing I want to ask, though, because I was curious after watching your snazzy doc you had, was the nickname Rue. Where is that from?
Oh, gosh.
The Rue Crew.
The Rue Crew. Yeah, so you have a dog and you kind of like take their name and then add like a little ending to it. Like my dog's name is Murphy. We call him Murphy Moo, right?
Yeah.
So I think it was either my mom or maybe my grandmother called me Reagan Rue.
Oh.
And so then Rue just stuck. And all through high school, like, that's all I was called. Like, Reagan did not even really exist, whether it was amongst family, friends, on, like, social media. It was just Rue all the time. Huh. It wasn't until I went to college that, you know, naturally you don't introduce yourself as your nickname, right? I'm Rue. So, but, like, it just kind of fit well, like, the race being called Run, Rabbit, Run.
Yeah.
And some friends in Denver who came out to the race decided to make shirts, you saw in the documentary, and do Run, Rue, Run. Then they just became the Rue Crew, and that's what it is. And it's funny, though, because, like, I would actually, I kind of still wish that everyone just knew me as Rue.
Yeah.
Like, it just, it's more fun. It's cute.
That's the pro con about moving from your hometown is you can kind of reinvent yourself and your identity.
Yeah.
But there are certainly people, but sometimes little idiosyncrasies like that, that you want to kind of carry with you.
Right. And they just inevitably drop off.
Yeah. Because you're not going to recreate that and go, hey, call me Rue. Right. Why? Yeah.
Yeah. So I loved it though. It was fun for it to like show back up like that because it really hasn't been since like high school sports that everyone who would say like cheering me on was calling me Rue instead of Reagan.
Well, it reminds me, did you see the group near the finish line of Leadville this past year that had, they were all like wearing these purple shirts. It was like a group of like 10 people roughly around our age in their like 20s. Yeah, we're going nuts for everyone that was coming towards.
Were they out there supporting the girl who ran it in, or she ended up DNFing, but she ran in Chacos?
I don't know.
Because there was a rowdy crew. I'm talking like, them. And they were young. They were young. They were very.
Were there like two or three guys? That
But like 10 deep
them.
In total, it felt like.
Yeah, it was
them.
Yeah,
okay.
it was probably them. I thought she did finish. Maybe she DNFed. She tried to do it in Chacos?
We might not be talking about the same racer, but
okay.
I saw her come through Lakes and she, Chacos. I still wish to this day I knew what her like story was or why she wanted to do that, because to me it's like, who's going to be able to make it a Leadville marathon?
Why, I mean, why waste your race entry on that?
You're
yeah.
summiting Hope's Pass in Chacos, Chuck. Right? It's, like my feet blistered in actual running shoes, and you're going to go do that. So I still to this day have thought about it. I'm like, what was her intent? Like, was it some sort of movement that like I don't know about?
That's the funny thing with these races too, and I think marathons carry that same vibe where you get a lot of people that have interesting stories or things they're raising money for.
Yeah.
But specifically in the ultra races and especially these like major ones like Leadville, I think you see a lot of these people that have either documentary crews like yourself at your race or a certain t-shirt or people out there and you like wonder like, what is your story?
Yeah.
And specifically in the running space, although ultra running has become a lot more commercialized and trail running has got more attention lately, it's still very much a niche sport.
Yeah.
Where you get these like strange characters, and a lot of times the people that win the races or that do these odd things, they have like no social following. So then when you stumble upon it, you're like, oh, that's really unique. Kind of like the guy I was telling you about, Andy Glaze, which I think a lot more people know about now since when I had him on the podcast about a year ago. This guy running 100 miles every week for no reason. He like
just doing it,
gets offered sponsorships or ads, I'm sure all the time, turns them all down, which like I so respect, but I'm also like, you can take a few, we're not gonna call
help
you
out with a race registration or something.
So it's crazy just for the love of it, I guess.
There was I don't know exactly, no, actually it might have been the 100, the female who won the 100 this past year, coached by the SWAP folks, David and Megan Roach. I don't know if you've heard of them or listened to their podcast.
So.
Okay. They train like pretty much like the best ultra runners, at least in the United States. They have a lot of international athletes too. Mm-hmm. But so she like wins level 100, which is huge. And I check her Instagram and like maybe has 900 followers and has posted five times. But like, I kind of respect that about them, right?
Yeah.
Because like,
you know they're doing it for quote unquote the right reasons.
Right.
Know?
And yeah. I'm not trying to say that I'm not doing it for the right reasons, but I also just like make time to be able to like share this journey, because the amount of people who have, and I know you get these all the time too, but like messages of people being like, hey, like I just ran my first race. Like your page is so cool. Or I love that you run and strength train. How do I do that? So the posting isn't necessarily to, you know, boast about accomplishments or to even get so fixated on growing my content or growing my followers, but it's more so like I'm having a really fun time showing this and sharing this. And the bonus point or the cherry on top is that it is growing and now more people do get to see it.
Yeah, that's the funny thing about not just running, but you're starting to see a lot more running influencers in the past year or two. But I saw it from the lifting space for years where the people that get the big sponsorships and the people that get the big followings, a lot of times they're just amateurs, like myself included. Like they're just, you know, you might have a more impressive physique than the average person, or you might lift decent weight, but you're not the record holder. You're not, you know, the one winning in bodybuilding Mr. Olympia, or you're not the one winning Leadville.
Yeah.
But I think there's that bit of relatability with these people. And, you know, speaking, like you said, a lot of people get inspired from the people that make the content more than they do the people that are winning the races.
Yeah.
And I experienced that a lot in my last 50 miles. I actually kind of caught off guard because I had like three or four people come up to me. And because I don't think I'm like that big or anything like that. And they were like, hey, we saw, you know, your 50 mile race, or hey, saw your video with Joey at Leadville, inspired me to come out here and run this 100. That's so cool. Like, I was actually like lifted up there. I was like, wow. Like,
yeah.
I see people watch it. Like, you see the thousands of people now watch your doc, and you're like, okay, I see the 20,000 number. But when you meet even just like five of those 25,000 or 20,000, it's like, oh, wow, like these are real people that are, I'm impacting their life. And it's cool to have that, like you said, cheer on top, because from my perspective, I don't create from a attitude of necessarily helping other people.
Yeah.
If I'm being honest, it's more from an area of documenting my life. And I have a passion just for creating content around whatever I'm into.
Yeah.
And if I can help people, obviously I'm more than happy to do so. But it's wild, but it is interesting seeing like that, that crossover between like the people that win that have no one knows who they are. And
the ones who deserve the attention aren't getting like
the rare examples are like a Courtney Dowalter, right? But it's again like two or three, or like a, you know, Killian Jornet or something like that.
Yeah.
But let's talk about you specifically. I want to hear more about your athletic background, because I feel like as soon as I stumbled upon your Instagram, I knew that, you know, you, and even same with Jesse, I can look at your body and tell you CrossFit.
Yeah.
You know, there's just like a look, a build to it. Maybe it's the shoulders or the
that.
Quads. Yeah. And there's pride in it, right? It's like, I mean, it's good to have that recognition.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about your background before CrossFit, getting into CrossFit. What was behind all that?
Yeah. So we'll go back to, middle school, high school, early high school is really where I decided to start working out. Just became like probably typical, like, girl in her teenage years. I was like, man, I kind of want to like lose a little bit of weight.
Well, I wonder, because that was a question, because for guys, it's cliche. You want to look good for girls. So you went into high school, you're like, let me hit the curls and hit the bench press. It's like a masculine thing to do.
Yeah.
For girls though, although a lot more women are lifting nowadays, I was curious about that. So carry on.
Yeah. So, and like, I always like have this weird fear that like people are going to like hear me tell this story on one podcast and then it's like redundant to them. So I always feel like I certainly want to tell it and be thorough, but to really give you like the nutshell version and while still telling all about it, it was, you're going to laugh at this, October 31st. It was like Halloween night. And I'm like, I probably had like one too many pieces of candy. And I basically was just remember being in this phase where I was like, I felt like I was a little bit like heavier than I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking like middle school. Like I probably was just holding on to baby fat. In fact, I know that I was.
Yeah.
But long story short, I decide to like download my Fitness Pal and start doing things like not necessarily eating significantly cleaner, but just moderating my food.
More
making
awareness.
Like making a little bag of like Lay's salt and vinegar chips last like 3 days because I'm going by the serving sizes instead of like deciding I'm never going to eat one.
So
again.
You didn't go into like an eating disorder. You just went to a bit more awareness of your own dietary behavior.
For sure. Now, I will say where that took me was I ended up deciding to get a trainer.
Yeah.
And the trainer owned a brand, and he actually trained like NPC bikini and bodybuilding competitors. And I'm 15 years old. I'm like, I'm all in on this like personal training. In fact, what my schedule looked like in high school was I got out of school at 2:30, 3 o'clock. I went to tennis practice. From tennis, I went directly to travel softball, and then travel softball to the gym at 7:30 for my session from 7:30 to 8:30. Home, homework, cook, bed, sleep, repeat.
Yeah.
And this is at like 15 years old. And so he sees this in me and he's like, hold on a second. Like, she's got some work ethic. She's got it, right? So he's thinking about his brand and he's like, I want a 16-year-old on stage. I want, because he knows in his mind, undoubtedly, I'll probably be like one of the youngest that a panel of judges will see. And sure enough, I did two of those competitions, and I was the youngest that two panel of judges had ever seen. So I trained for the bikini category.
Yeah.
I didn't have enough muscle anywhere other than my legs. I actually got points deducted for
quads
being too big in the bikini segment.
That's so cool. I did not know you had that bodybuilding background. Okay.
Well, because it's nowhere on my Instagram. Because I mean, like, I'm 16.
When you were really young.
I'm young, and you know what you have to be up in there. I mean, you're like in like next to nothing, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, my dad to this day is like, how did I let you do that? But it was for the sport. It was for the event, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really where it began. But at the end of that second one, I was like, so I was 16 years old, and I thought to myself, A, I can tell I'm forming a really bad relationship with food.
Yeah.
And B, I looked so incredibly fit, but I was so unincredibly fit. Mm. And I didn't like that. Like, I knew that I had sculpted my body to look up to look a specific way because of the way that I was working out, because of the way that I was eating, the water pills you take to make everything pop. Mm. But if you needed me to go out and, like, do any sort of functional fitness or, heaven forbid, run, mm. I wouldn't have been able to. So I was like, I don't want this to be what my fitness is about. Like, I want to be strong. I want to be functional. And then the running just happened years and years and years later.
Yeah.
I only found running like four years ago.
So like the disconnect between like what you appear to be capable of doing and what you could actually do just felt unsettling.
Yeah, I was like a transformer that actually couldn't like attack something. That's kind of the way I'd put it, right? Yeah. I looked like I could, you know, take on the world, but from a fitness perspective, I wouldn't have said that I was that fit.
Yeah. So you started kind of more that bodybuilding background. I know exactly like what kind of training and diet. And
oh, you know.
I used my fitness pal for years. And,
yeah.
And we don't need to go down the diet train, but it is a funny thing because I think for the most part, tracking macros and understanding your dietary behavior is incredibly empowering and valuable. And I think mm-hmm. people get it twisted with the idea of tracking your macros as being an automatic eating disorder.
Right.
I think for some people it can be, and it can be like the gateway into a lot of issues. But for a lot of people, it's very helpful. It's kind of like just journaling. Okay, what am I eating? Because to your point, like serving sizes are not what they seem.
Right.
Like that scoop of peanut butter is probably like 2 or 3 servings.
Yeah.
But transitioning it back, you have that kind of style of training. What led you into CrossFit? Because that's a very different kind of training.
Yeah. So senior year, so fast forward. So once I said no to the competitions, mm-hmm. I still continued to do the bodybuilding style lifting just on my own and not for those purposes.
Yeah.
So then my mom had a friend and she was just like jacked. Like she was easily in her like late 40s at this point, like I'm 17, 18 years old, and she's jacked. His shoulders are like ripped, like
women,
abs.
For some reason, I mean, CrossFit gets men jacked too, but it gets women jacked a lot more proportionally than men.
Yeah.
Even bodybuilding, like women obviously grow muscle bodybuilding, but if you want jacked shoulders and like quads, I'll pick a CrossFitter who's going to have more muscle than a bodybuilder.
I'll tell you why, because there's not a single day you walk into a CrossFit gym that some sort of movement is not
engaging
the quads.
Yeah,
I look back at pictures of myself. I mean, I just posted a reel about it the other day. It's the one I was referring earlier, kind of went mm-hmm. a little bit viral. And my legs are monstrous, like huge. Mm-hmm. And like, it's really cool. I go through phases now where I'm like, are my legs small? Like, I look like
Me
a runner?
Too. It's really hard. Yeah.
And then I, you know, just, you know, correct the dialogue real quick. Yeah. But, okay. So yes, she was jacked and I was like, this is really cool. I want to look like that. And so like the typical like bandwagon behavior, you uh-huh. see something that you want to be like, and so you do what that person is doing.
Yeah.
So, and this CrossFit gym had just opened up. I grew up in a really small town. So like for a CrossFit gym to be there was kind of odd, kind of new, had everyone excited. And so that's where that started. So I did CrossFit my entire senior year, continued it in college, and then ended up getting my L1 certification. Mm-hmm. Thanks to my dad. He paid for it so I could do it.
Nice.
And then I coached CrossFit in college.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and love it. Like I still love it. I still miss it a little bit. Just
yeah.
like, it's not what I want to ever be competitive in. And so
I think we have the same feeling with lifting, just in like you with CrossFit, me more with bodybuilding. So I've
yeah.
actually had a little bit more of a resurgence with, I've obviously always still lifted through this running journey of mine, and still lift 6 days a week. But especially after moving here and just having the garage gym, I haven't had the machines and cables yeah. to bodybuild in the same way. But I have had this string pulling at me to get
yeah.
back into it in some way. But like you said, to the point of not for competitive reasons, though.
Yeah.
Like there is, you know, that line. But just I think because I really enjoy the style of training.
Yeah.
You know, like as much as I want the functionality thing, and I do a lot more of that now, and I still would. There is something I was telling a friend of mine. I was like, the pump just feels amazing.
Yeah.
It feels amazing the entire time versus
yeah.
like strength training. You feel cool and it's great, and you have that pride and you're much more capable.
Yeah.
And running feels great when you finish and you have the runner's high sometimes. But the pump is great every time, the entire time. So, I love that training. Yeah. So I was like, I need to get back to this more often.
Do you feel like you can achieve that in your garage gym, or do you feel like you don't have quite all the stuff you need?
With most things. So like I can, I mean, all you can do with biceps is curl, right?
Right.
So you just curl variations, good.
Yeah.
I'd say like, you know, shoulders even, I can get a pretty good pump. Chest, depending on things, I can. To your point where your mind's probably thinking, it's like, I can't get the isolated work as much.
With like cables and stuff?
Cables are a big one, like a pec deck fly for chest, or even leg extension for quads. Like, I got a pump over holiday break with like some of the gyms I was going to, and I was like, man, it was like a hack squat or a leg extension. Yeah. I was like, this is amazing. So it just, and also the thing about lifting I want to ask you is it does something different for me mentally and physically than running. So like running is like my solitary time. I can go into a different space where I kind of have a long time to think about either emotional issues or stressors or whatever. And I can kind of analyze and regulate all that during the run. Versus lifting, and I'm totally undistracted on the run. I can't pull out my phone, maybe for a quick, you know, reel or whatever.
Yeah,
but generally it's away. Lifting, because you have the rest period, sometimes your phone's out. Oftentimes I'm more listening to music where running, sometimes I'm not. And lifting, I feel like I can let more aggressive emotions out, like on the weights, especially like when I was deadlifting more often, like any kind of anger or thoughts or anything. I feel like I can just pour it into a hard rep or set versus running. It'd be like randomly sprinting hard, and it would like mess you up because then you're trying to recover. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
So like it does something different for me mentally and physically, and that's why the balance of the two is so just fulfilling for me.
Yeah.
What is that like for you?
So, I mean, I don't know that I ever feel like I'm necessarily, you know, exerting some of this like angry or like emotional energy, right?
Yeah.
But to me, let me back up a little bit. Going back to your pump.
Mm-hmm.
As a female, like, and I remember saying this to my mom when I was like 15. I was like, it is, as a female, if I want to always have a feminine look, there is at some point in my mind, there's a line that I have to watch out for, right?
Yeah.
That also has a lot to do with the type of body that you naturally have. So more petite women who do not naturally hold on to a lot of extra weight or a lot of extra fat, and they can only put on muscle. Even them, I feel like they have a little bit of like a longer, more prosperous road where they can just like really keep like working and getting this pump you're talking about. For me, like I would never describe myself as a petite person. My older sister has more of that, like that thin petite build. Don't get me wrong, she's beautiful, but like we have completely different builds, right? And so unless I'm like on this cutting diet where I'm like stripping away every ounce of fat, I, in my eyes, begin to just look a little bit bulky.
I think it's like the muscle bellies and the shapes, like you said, like the certain genetic or build you have.
Yes.
Fills out more.
Yeah. So I'm like, right now, the way that I look at strength training is I know that it like, it vastly supports my running. Like I've gone weeks without strength training, lower body specifically, the first thing that I feel as I'm running consistently are my knees hurting.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, nope, okay, so I need this, right? But the other thing, and I'm just gonna be like super blunt about this, it's an aesthetics thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like I like, and I always have liked to be a little bit more muscular, to be on like the leaner side. And so for me, it's like checking off a box that I need mentally because of the outcome that I want or I'm aiming for physically.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, I don't really tie any sort of emotional stance that I have to running or lifting.
Mm-hmm.
Like it is not like an emotional thing to me. Unless I'm getting really close to a finish line, then I might feel a little bit, but I don't ever think like, oh, running is where I'm going to get like time alone or time to think. And I almost like, I think I kind of envy that a little bit out of people who like see it that way.
When I don't want to mischaracterize my stance on it, it's not like I go in there and I'm like sobbing on my runs or I'm like yelling at the barbell, but it's more so, I think just being able to like, just the serotonin, like the...
Yeah.
hormonal release.
It also fills different buckets for you. Yeah. Is the way I'm hearing it. This is what running gives you. This is what weight training gives you. Yeah.
Each thing gives me a little thing. And even like, you know, reading does a similar thing for me as running, where it is forced time away from devices and input.
Yes.
So that's also why I get up really early, because no one else is up. So I'm not getting client emails. I'm not getting social media, bings and all that.
Yeah.
So it's a good isolating factor with that.
Is your morning routine every day? Do you lift first thing?
Yeah. So kind of first thing, kind of not. So my routine is obviously wake up. It has to be the first thing. Eat breakfast, coffee, read.
Okay.
So that takes up maybe like 80-ish, 90 minutes, and then I'll lift. So if I get up, I usually get up at 3:50 in the morning. I'm usually lifting at like 6:10. I stopped you there.
You people who do like before 4:30 in the morning, that's another level. That's the middle of the night to me.
Well, the funny thing is, if you got used to it, you'd probably change your mindset, which would be like, okay, well, duh. But for the longest time, 6 a.m. felt like early to me.
Okay.
And then once I got to, you know, used to 3:50, now 6 a.m. feels like sleeping in.
Okay, but let me ask you this. Did you go from 6 a.m. to 3:50, or did it go 6 a.m., okay, I want to wake up a little bit earlier, let me do 5:30, or did you just like one day decide, in order for me to have the day and get all the things done I need to in a day, I need to wake up at 3:50?
Probably 3 points. So first, why the 50 is probably what some people are thinking, like, why not just 4, you know? The 10 minutes is more so a buffer, and where the buffer originates and where the time in general originates is a bit from in college when I was personal training. I had a client that I had to meet at 6 a.m.
Okay.
And so I'd get up, or it's 5 a.m., whatever it was. I'd get up and I wanted to give myself a buffer if breakfast took a little bit longer, there's traffic, something like that. So that's where the 10 minutes come from.
Okay.
That's where a bit of the getting up early comes from.
Yeah.
And when I started training him earlier, I was like, well, you know, I was on college campus. I was like, why don't I just lift while I'm there? It makes sense.
Yeah.
But I was nervous. I was like, I'm going to be so weak in the morning. Like, I'll only have one meal in me. But after I did it a few times, I was like, oh, like, I actually really like this. Yeah. I have the entire day now free. Like, I've knocked it out. Long story short, the last point I'll make about waking up early for me is it has nothing to do with vanity or what, you know, look how hardcore I am or anything like that, mentally tough. But more so it's, I just find that I'm extremely productive if I get up early and I have more daylight.
Okay.
So like if I feel like I'm, and this goes with most things, I feel like I'm fairly useless after 2 or 3 o'clock. Like I'm just not as efficient.
I so agree with that.
That in mind, if I can get an extra hour or two in my morning, well now I've just made myself productive for 8 hours instead of 6.
Yeah.
So To me, it like lengthens my productivity time, and I feel like, okay, well, by the time Reagan's getting up at 7 a.m. in her cushy warm bed, I've already lifted, read, had breakfast. I'm already, you know, on to work.
I totally get it. I totally get it. In the late summer, it's actually when I met Jesse, and we started doing a ton of morning runs together. She's a little one, so she like has to do everything in the morning.
Yeah.
And we were like meeting. There were some days we were like pulling up to the trailhead at 5:30 in the morning, and we'd get an eight to 10 mile run done. And to your point, it's like you're not meaning for it to sound boastful, or like this, you know, saying it in vain. But you're like, look at everything I've gotten done while some people are sleeping. And it's not a comparison thing. It's more so just like you feel proud of yourself, right?
Yeah. There's a bit of the pride to it, and then there's the practicality. So it's like you get a little bit of the pride. You know, there's something there. It's kind of like the aesthetic, right?
Yeah.
Like we both want to look the part. We want to look fit. You know, I don't really trust people that say they don't care if they don't look fit.
Right.
You know? But so there's a little bit of that. And then, like I said, the practicality of it, right?
Yeah.
Like waking up early.
So when do you get your run done?
So runs are usually, especially with 2-a-days, it's tough. If it's a 2-a-day, I'll try and I'm closer to a race. I'll run in the morning and lift in the evening. But I try and knock it down early, but now because of how cold it is, it's getting pushed back.
So if you do a lift in the morning, are you doing like a work day in between and then like running as your last thing? Or are you doing like running as like a lunch break? Or does it just look different all the time?
It kind of looks different, but usually it's like an early afternoon, something like that.
Okay.
So let's get into your running journey specifically, because we kind of covered how all the lifting notes and tidbits. What drew you into running specifically, and was it immediately trail running, or did you kind of dabble with the road first? Because obviously, I know you raised in Georgia, and me being raised in Virginia, there's trails around, but if you grew up in the suburbs, it's not that accessible.
Oh, trails in South Georgia are like if you can run around the perimeter of a cotton field.
Yeah.
Like, kid you not. There's like no such thing as a trail in the tiny town that I grew up in.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's actually a fun story. So through high school, my primary sports were softball, basketball, and tennis.
Mm-hmm.
And at our high school, they ran like kind of like a dual athlete program where if like the track team needed some extra points on the board for specifically like region and state,
oh,
then they could like pull an athlete from the tennis team. So track fell when tennis was, and cross country fell when softball was.
Mm.
And so I guess like in the coach's eyes, I was like a decent enough runner that I could come run at region and state and just get the team some extra points. And so freshman year of high school, I go to run region, the 1 mile and 2 mile. And the coach that was the head coach of the track team was also my head coach in softball. So like I admired her. I always wanted to make her proud. But one thing I despised, absolutely despised, was running. And I certainly did not want to run around a track.
Yeah.
And so I'm at region and I'm like, you know what? Can't play a player. Like, I'm gonna sandbag.
Yeah.
This is horrible. I hate admitting this. I'm gonna sandbag. I know that the top four go to state and I don't want to go to state. So I'm gonna intentionally put myself in fifth place around this track and I'm just gonna hold this position. I round the track on this eighth lap and my coach is going crazy. And turns out I'd lapped that person in front of me, so it looked like I was in fifth.
Oh.
But I was in
fourth.
How
did you not realize that?
I don't know. I don't know. I was so like the person that flipped the card every time you came around the track and it counted down from 8 to 1.
Oh.
It's like comical.
By 8, it's hard to remember.
Yeah, and here's the thing, like it's comical, right? I look back and I'm like, I couldn't wrap my brain around 8 laps around a track, but now I've completed a 100-mile race. Like, how does that happen?
Yeah.
So anyway, so like looking back, I can see now that I had a little bit of a natural knack for running, but I never loved it by any means. So fast forward to college, and I'm a server in college, and I walk up to Kristen. She was like a stranger just like eating. And she's like, what do you do? And so I talk about CrossFit. She's like, oh, you know, I run ultras. I'd never heard that word before. I thought the marathon distance was like the pinnacle of running. And that's just where
it ended.
I'd
never heard of it until a few years ago, too.
And the first time you hear it, you're like,
what?
You cannot wrap your brain around it.
Yeah.
And so I utter the words, I've only ever run 4 miles without stopping, and I'll never have a need to do more. And she's like, she invites me on a 6 mile trail run. And so I'm like, I was hooked. Mm. And so it was that same year that I ran my first half, full, and ultra.
Mm.
Ultra being the 50K distance. And I loved
it.
I loved it. I was like, this is so fun. And just to be able to like see new places. Cause then it took us like into the AT, cause at this point it's in Georgia. So I was like, all of this is out there that I have no idea.
Yeah, it is very much like where it takes you. And before we get to the 100-mile race, it kind of ties to something we talked about off camera before the podcast, was about competitiveness.
Yeah.
Because like you said, kind of quickly you had a knack for it. And I do feel like, and it's not true for everyone, it's not like you can never get better, because clearly you can be more competitive and become a better runner later on. But a lot of the top racers that I do notice usually have, like I said, a CrossFit background with women.
Yeah.
Or some kind of cross-country background or soccer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like there are these markers where you go, oh, that's why they can pick it up so quickly, where the first few races they do, you can already see on Ultra sign up.
Yeah.
They're there, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, glancing at yours, I saw pretty quickly, like you're in those top 5, top 10 pretty quickly in those races. Did that definitely lead you to falling more in love with the sport? And then where do you view your competitiveness now? Maybe kind of, again, refer back to the rambles we were going on.
So when I saw that Ultra Sign Up had a ranking system, it was like, I was like,
it's
done
addictive.
For. I was like, what is this, right? And it's like to this day why I'm like, again, maybe a little bit of a vanity metric here, but like I'm terrified of DNFing one day because I haven't DNFed yet and I don't
you
want
have a
to.
Do not start.
I do have one. Do not start. I had COVID.
Yeah.
I had COVID. Yeah.
Your perfect streak is affected. Now, at least it's a do not start.
I'm kidding. So I'm like, I know that percentage, like that ranking is just something that I'm like, now granted, the more races you have, like the ranking helps you when you only have a small amount of races, right? Because like if you play second in two races, you look like a an animal, right? Yeah. Really, you just run two times. But so when I saw that, like, I could always kind of like look at this number and keep these kind of top five, top 10 finishes, because mm-hmm. like in my half, I was like, I think like first in my age group, I don't know what it was overall, mm-hmm. but then like I placed second in my first ultra. Mm-hmm. And again, I kind of have this habit of letting like imposter syndrome like play in a little bit, where I'm like, oh, well, maybe I was just having a good day. Maybe mm-hmm. luck was in my favor. And I never even really realized, I never heard the term imposter syndrome until I actually Googled one day, like, why do I always give my performance? Why do I always give luck?
Attribute it to something else.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, why do I give luck the credit? I think I phrased it like that, and up mm-hmm. popped this article about imposter syndrome. And so anyway, so going back to the competitiveness, yes, being able to like kind of see these like quick wins just lit a fire in me. And then when I was like, I want to take this seriously enough that I'm willing to move to Colorado and like train in the mountains and at mm-hmm. elevation, that's where I'm like, you know what? Maybe I won't ever be a part of the elite, or maybe I won't ever be like a part of like the fastest group, but that's not going to stop me from training like I want to yeah. be there, right? And so it's yeah. like, and I can't turn my competitive switch off.
Well, you know, I was telling you, I'm not usually too competitive in some of these things, and I think I am and I'm not. I told you I'm more competitive with myself, so I have certain standards for efforts, and as long as I give, you know, a high standard of effort, I'm okay with wherever it lies. But there are times where I wish I had, or if I'd like to enact it more, the competitiveness that you or like my friend Jeremy have, just because I think that's the right attitude of it. And I fall into it a lot, whether it's running, lifting, even like the philosophy I read or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, well, you know, I read this stuff, but like I could never write like so-and-so, or I could yeah. never have the physique of so-and-so or run a race like that. And maybe I can't. Maybe it's a genetic thing, or maybe I didn't start young enough. You know, there yeah. are some sports like boxing, for example. If you start too late, like you're too behind the eight ball, or like, you know, you can't make it up that curve. But there is an idea of, well, at least see how far you can get. If you yeah. give it like your full effort, maybe you aren't the top five elite in the world, but maybe yeah. you get way further than you ever realized you were capable of.
Yeah.
And you kind of go all in on it. So,
but this is also why I'm actually so glad you brought this up. I think ultra running is the only sport that I could have this much confidence in that I can be competitive one day, for one reason. And that's that it has been proven time and time again that in this sport, females specifically, but males and females, get better at ultra running as they get older.
Yeah.
Right? So right now, if you were like, Reagan, do you want to be a competitive CrossFitter? I would look at you and say, heck no, I don't have time to be a competitive CrossFitter, mm-hmm. right? Like, the 18-year-olds are the ones dominating yeah. the CrossFit floor now. But if you look at a lot, like, I'm 25 years old, and I'm still, like, kind of in infancy stages of this sport. I found running 3 or 4 years ago, but only this past year that I finally start paying a coach to mm-hmm. program for me and to actually train, like, consistently and really, like, relentlessly for it, right? Yeah. So in, like, my timeline, I'm like, I'm a baby in this. Mm-hmm. And I'm not, you know, crushing numbers or anything, but I'm also not hanging in the back of the pack, like I'm doing okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so the one thing about ultra running that I love is, like, I'm 25 years old. A lot of the women that I look up to are at the youngest late 20s.
Yeah.
But the big names in this sport are like 30s, late 30s. I'm like, yeah. I have all the time in the
world.
There
does seem to be an interesting demarcation line for like elite athletes and peaking in the sport with ultra running
yes.
versus any other sport.
Any other sport, yes.
Yeah, because I mean, I do think of like Harvey Lewis, right, who wins a lot of those last man standing ones.
Yeah.
He's in his like mid-late 40s, I yep. think. And again, like you referenced, I think, you know, Doe Walter, I think she's like 37, 38 now.
39 maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she's up there, but still at her like peak of her powers, at least for now. And
right.
a lot of the racers are. So that is a great point. And I think there's also that thing you could fall back on as far as, hey, here's where I'm doing, where I'm brand new to the sport. I haven't dialed everything in.
Yeah.
What if I did go the extra distance, you know, not to make it a pun, to dial in these other facets of the sport and of my training, of my diet?
Right.
Where could I end up?
Well, and then it's like, and this goes with anything, this is not necessarily specific to ultra running, but it's really exciting to think about, like, okay, if I keep putting in the work and I stay consistent and assuming that something out of my control is not going to happen, like an injury, why would I ever get worse at this point?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So if you kind of like the way that you see yourself, like, you know, where you see yourself in a race pack might be different where I see myself in a race pack. But no matter where that point is, we each probably believe that we are going to get, we're going to move further up that line, mm-hmm. because we're going to keep doing it. Unless we're going to stop, or unless we're going to get injured, or unless something like physiologically happens with us, we're going to get better. And so mm-hmm. that's like so exciting to me, because I'm like, I'm young, I'm healthy, I love yeah. it, I'm willing to put in the work, and I kind of want to be competitive.
So the hard thing about starting something new, and I have plenty of examples, but I'll even think about yours. Different things you started new, whether it's CrossFit or running or whatever it may be, there's a lot of intimidation of, you look at the summit, right, and how far you have to go, and maybe, you know, these people are so much better than you, it's so new to you. But there's also a freedom in that, because you can let go of your ego and say, well, I'm not a runner anyway.
Yeah.
And this is just, you know, it's gravy to me. I'm only going to get better, and there's so much room
yeah.
to get better. So that's like two ways of looking at it, is, oh, God, I'm so far from where I want to be, where it's like, well, I have so much to gain over the years yeah. of into the sport. So
yeah.
Let's talk about the 100. Before we get to the race itself, why 100? And I only ask that. It's a classic question. I'm sure you've been asked a lot. Yeah. I only ask it because I've been asked it a lot, and I think yeah. my answer changes every few weeks.
Okay.
But why the 100, and then why specifically, you know, Run Rabbit?
Yeah. As far as why the 100, when I first started ultra running, I probably, like a lot of people, became pretty obsessed with Courtney DeWalter. I watched her documentary, The Source, like to a point where I could like repeat it back to you right now, like the whole hour long documentary. It was like a nightly thing.
Running docs are pretty cool.
They are pretty cool. Yeah. So it was just one of those things where it was like, at this point, 3 to 4 years ago, I actually still did not know that the 200, like the beyond 100 were a thing. Yeah. So the 100 was like the summit. And it only really made sense in my typical behaviors to go, oh, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. And just kind of decided. Another thing that I got hooked on pretty quickly was I wanted to be like one of the youngest in the fields of the 100 that I was choosing. But that was when I was like 21, and in my mind I was gonna be able to run a 100 by the time I was like 23, but things just, like, life just happened, like moved from Georgia, all of that. So really, I mean, it sounds kind of surface level, but the 100 was just because it was like, it was the distance to do.
It's a pretty number.
It's three digits instead of two, right? Yeah. Like, it was just, okay, I did a 50K. I loved it. I can do
and
more.
And here in America, we don't go by kilometers. It's miles. So 100K is nothing. 100 right. miles. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So it was just like the rite of passage. Like, it just felt like it was the right thing to do. It's crazy because I think I also kind of envisioned that I would always do a 50 miler before the 100, and I didn't. When I did the 100, the longest distance I'd previously run was 62. 40.
Okay, it was the Never Summer, right?
Yeah, but I did the 60K.
60K, yeah.
So it was supposed to be roughly 38. They did a last minute reroute, and it was like 39.8, so 40 miles. So
were you nervous then, jumping that big of a distance? Or you were like, I'll figure it out?
No, I was like, I was so confident. Okay. Like, I just knew it. I told my friends, I told my family. I was like, guys, like, I'm going to finish this.
Well, here's my thing, too. I think when you're finishing in the top of your field and at, like, that distance, then you go, well, maybe I won't be top of the field at the next distance, but I certainly won't be back of the field. Because that's where I go mentally is, hey, before I sign up for 100, I need to be at least middle of the pack in my 50s before I do that. And luckily, I've been there
now.
You
have been, yeah.
But for a while, I was like, man, because like in my first 50, I was second to last. And I was like, man, I cannot be chasing cutoffs in the 50s and then go and try and run 100.
To a 100, yeah. Yeah, and that's the thing, too. You bring up a good point. Like, I had not experienced a race where I chased cutoffs and...
Like us peasants?
No, shut up. No, again, like, maybe it was the races I was choosing. Never Summer was my, to this day, the most confidence-boosting race I've run. Mm-hmm. I went into that race knowing that, like, you know, it didn't necessarily bring, like, you know, runners from all over the world to it or anything, or even all over the nation, but, like, it's a pretty well-known race in Colorado. It had, like, insane vert, and to run in the fifth-place position for... majority of the race, fifth place overtook me within like half a mile. She had like an insane kick. I finished sixth by like 30 seconds. But it was like, holy cow, like I just did that. Like I put up a good time, and so that was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
So not to avoid your other question as far as why Run Rabbit, going back to the obsession with Courtney DeWalter in the beginning of my ultra world or ultra like findings, that was her first 100.
Is that the one she DNF'd?
And then she went back to it.
I'm sure she went back. Yeah. And probably swept but that the was field, the one.
Yeah. So if you've watched that documentary, The Source, she talks a lot about it. And so then since I moved out here, it made sense and seemed fun to do one in the state of Colorado. And then I kind of talk a little bit about this in the documentary, but I don't love super verdy courses or races, but it never fails. If I am going to gain on someone or drop someone behind me, it's when I'm hiking, not when I'm running. Mm-hmm. So I think I do have, like, I think I'm a decent hiker. And so it made sense for me to pick a race that has
our lifting background. I'm a better climber too.
Freaking hamstrings are just rolling back there. Yeah. So like 20K a vert and Run Rabbit. So 2022. And so I was like, yeah, I'll do it. Time of year is great. So
why haven't you switched to the long shorts like Courtney?
I don't rock them as well as she does. And I'm like, you know, if I'm going to like do all these squats and stuff, I might as well.
I think there's sometimes there's certain like garments, whether it's a hat or a certain style or whatever, that someone just wears it so frequently and like audaciously that it works for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like there's some people that'll rock like a
cut off shirt.
No, well, I wasn't going to say that, but I was going to say like, it's not a fanny pack, but what's like the man bag or whatever that people...
Or is it a fanny pack, but they're just wearing it around their
chest?
Yeah,
I forgot what they call it, but I'm like, I would look so corny wearing that. Like, I would never wear that. But like some people, I'm like, that's fine for them. It works, like a certain, you know, thing.
Yeah.
So, but...
Or maybe it's just the achievements they have, like Courtney.
Yeah, you don't
question them.
She can
wear whatever
you
want.
Yeah, that's very much likely what it is. Talking about the Rue crew that we kind of kicked off the conversation with, what was your experience? So I would ask why such a big crew, but okay. I know it. You got all these sisters, you want your whole family there. I totally get that, so I won't even ask that. But what was the pro cons reflecting back of having that many people in your face while you're like 60 miles deep and you're like puking trying to eat something?
Yeah, okay, so... The family is the obvious one.
Yeah.
I cannot say enough about them. Like, I think they will be at every race going forward because not only did I love it, they loved it.
Yeah.
Now, Michelle and Blake and their little one, Miller, that you see. So we actually met them on a plane. Like, we were two legs to get to Hawaii, two legs to get back.
Mm-hmm.
On the fourth and final plane coming back, Michelle looks over at Kristen and she's like, we were on the last flight together. And Kristen's like, no, we've been on the last three flights together.
Mm.
And the friendship literally like was born like on that flight. And so they live in Denver. We live in the Springs. They hang out all the time. And they're like, they have these weird friends who run all the time. And we're those friends. And it was just like, it just made sense to invite them because we hang out with them all the time. They were close friends. They'd never been to something like that.
Close to Leadville.
Other than, they went to Leadville. So that's where they come into play. Where Jesse comes into play is actually probably like the superhero of the story, because I won't say the name of this person, but I had a pacer decide to back out on me within 48 hours of the race starting.
Oh man!
And in Run Rabbit, you get to pick up your first pacer at mile 46.
Yeah.
So I was never in a million years going to ask Kristen to go run. Like
40 miles of the whole race.
Exactly.
Pace twice. Yeah.
Exactly. So Kristen actually was the person who messaged Jesse because I felt bad and was like, hey, I know this is really last minute, but can you and Ethan and Easton come and support Reagan and be a pacer for her? And I don't know if you know this, but she ran the Pikes Peak Marathon on Sunday morning. Like, she paced me on Saturday. She ran 27 miles with me, and then she went and placed fifth.
Well, she's a tank. I need to meet her soon.
Yeah, you guys would be. She seems like an animal. She does the 3:45 alarms too, so you guys can go do that together. But so honestly, Brock, there was not a single con to it.
Really?
I would have that exact group of people at it was so cool. Like,
yeah, it's good to share that, right?
It was so cool to share it. Yeah. Like, they wanted that finish line as badly as I wanted it, mm-hmm. and they were just having the best time. We had a great Airbnb, so they had really easy access from, like, course to the house, so...
I think for me, I just think, like, my family specifically. So I have a brother who, he's a musician. He kind of does his own thing. Like, we aren't super close in the way that, like, we don't talk a bunch, but we don't have, like, any issues with each other. But we're very different creatures. Okay. You know, like, I'm more like the athlete.
Yeah.
He's more like the musician in that way. And then, so he would have no clue or anything about this whole ultra anything or interest, to be frank. And my parents, you know, they've been fit, you know, most of, you know, the entire time I've been, like, alive. They go to the gym often, but they don't understand running anything like this. And so they support the races. You know, my mom will call me before or after the race, you know, support me. But I feel like if I had them at the race, they would, one, be so just flabbergasted about the whole, you know,
and they
charade
were.
Of it all.
Yeah.
And two, I feel like they wouldn't know. They'd want me to quit sooner than, like, what I want. So, like, I would worry that they'd see me blistered up, you know, puking, trying to eat food.
Yeah.
And they'd be like, quit. When, in my mind, and, like, the people that I really want close to me are like, no. He just needs to, like, resettle.
Yeah.
And he'll keep going out, you know?
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of, like, lack of awareness on their end that I think they would be, like, overwhelmed by.
So this is kind of the way, and by the way, I get the...
The pause for it.
You want to be surrounded by people who recognize that even if you're in pain, like, you ultimately, if you're choosing to keep going, it means because you want to keep going.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you saw on the doc where my mom absolutely lost it at mile 70, like ugly cried.
Yeah.
Because I looked at her and, like, in desperation said, Mama, I have to eat. Or Mama, I think I said specifically. Yeah. So that is a really good point. However, my family is, we are like
close knit.
We are like this, right?
Yeah.
So the way that I think I kind of looked at it was like, if I don't want them to be at this one, then that probably means I maybe would not suggest that they come to all these ones in the future. Mm-hmm. But I do want them to be at the ones in the future, the ones that they can make. So I was like, well, y'all need to come to the big one, right? The, like, the championship of the year for like my book, for my calendar. Yeah. And it helped that I knew that they would be with one, or if not two, people who did know what to do. Mm-hmm. So Kristen, obviously, and then Jesse, exactly. And then my sister, my oldest sister, is very calculated, very organized. And so it was like, I wasn't just going to have, like, a group of people out there who potentially were like, what do we do next, right?
Yeah.
So it was really good. But I mean, you bring up a great point, because it was a lot of people.
So I wonder, specifically with this race, you said you weren't nervous going into it, but the factor of having it filmed, I wonder going into it, maybe that you weren't worried about, okay, well, I won't finish and it'll be caught on camera, but did the idea of having the race filmed change your feelings or emotions going into it?
I had an almost like, I had so much confidence going into that race that it actually didn't, like, dawn on me until I was out on the race course of like, oh, this is being documented.
Yeah.
But I, prior to it, no, I think I was more excited because, like, just like you do, I'm sure, like, any sort of new running doc that's uploaded on YouTube, mm-hmm. I watch it. And so now I knew that not only would I have this and it was going to display this, like, arguably probably one of the most important and challenging days of my life, mm-hmm. but I'm going to have it forever. And I trusted Chris so much to tell the story as I wanted it to be told, mm-hmm. and like seeing within the first like few hours of just like watching him work, mm-hmm. and how meticulous he was and how much of a perfectionist he was with this project, I was like, this is gonna be really good, like this is going to be like a top-notch project. So it really didn't, if anything, as far as the emotion, it just made me more excited, like mm-hmm. it made me more excited for there to be a big crew there and for there to be conversation at the aid stations. So
it did
good things for me instead of like bringing on more like nervous behaviors.
Yeah, because I think about it a little bit with Bighorn, especially being my first 100, I'm like, not just nervous about the race in general, finishing in general, I'm like, okay, you know.
Yeah.
But then on top of that, now I know it's being filmed. And then the biggest thing for me, being like a bit of a frugal guy, is I go, okay, how much money have I invested into this race?
Yeah.
I'm getting that buckle because I'm not wasting money.
Yeah. So but like when you think about the race, like is there, do you have any doubt that you'll finish? And if you do have any doubt, what is it rooted in?
Yeah, and that's what I go to, because the only thing that really makes me think is if I get into some crazy gut situation that I can't get myself out of, or if I have, you know, God forbid, some injury, right?
Yeah.
But it's not going to be a mindset, you know, falter. It's not going to be, you know, a lack of training that goes mm-hmm. into it. So once I analyze it in that way, the stress kind of goes out the window. But it's still, you know, when you're going into that unknown, you know, area. But describe a little bit of the course with Run Rabbit. So it's in Steamboat Springs, but a little bit of, you know, you mentioned it has a lot of vert. What generally was the course like, and are there any hard sections?
Yeah, so the most iconic thing about Run Rabbit Run is the fact that it starts summiting a ski slope.
Mm.
So 3.5 miles, you cover a little over 3,000 feet of vertical gain. So you're looking at 1,000 feet of gain per mile.
Your legs feel heavy by the time you get running.
Oh my gosh, it's crazy. You get to the top. Now your crew can take the gondola, and of course mine did, because why wouldn't they?
Mm-hmm.
And they get to see you like right when you get to that like 3 mile mark, and then you continue to climb, just not quite at that same grade, until about mile 5. That's where you've officially summited Mount Warner, and then you get like a really fun, just net down descent from mile 5 all the way to 15. It's like 10 miles. And so the race course is really unique. Like if you look at the profile, it starts and finishes at the same spot, mm-hmm. but it's not a complete out and back. So it's really like a bunch of like lollipops, right? Okay. So all these really big loops. Now, something that makes Run Rabbit really unique, and one of the reasons why I'm going back, is because you have crew accessible aid stations like 6 times.
That's nice.
Yeah. Which is really, like, how many times did you get to see your crew at Bighorn?
I think it's like 4 total, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that including start and finish or excluding?
I think it's excluding, because I think it's start, then there's, I think, 3 aid stations and like a turnaround. So I think you catch them on like those 2 out and like the 2 back.
Yeah. Okay. So once you see the crew at mile 14 at Run Rabbit, you do go like over 20 miles before you see them next. You see them like mile 43.
It's such an emotional uplifting just to see them.
You have
right?
no idea. Yeah. You have no, like it, and I needed
especially
it.
When you got the Rue crew.
I know. Yeah. Everyone's like covering me with blankets, rubbing my arms. Like it was like I was in a spa.
Yeah.
So, and then what's really neat about it is, so you're up in the mountains for miles, right? But the course brings you back into downtown Steamboat Springs.
Mm.
And so what you do there, so from mile 43 to roughly 50, you're running a very similar like gravel path that you have out there. And you're just running that net down. And then, so once you get to Olympian Hall and you get like crossed to the city, so now you're seeing lights and there's some cars, there's people like directing traffic for you.
Mm.
You see your crew like back to back there, because then you go and you do this really big 15 mile circle and make it back to them. So like, that's what I think makes like Run Rabbit really unique, is like you're way up in the mountains, but you do kind of revisit the town and you get to see the crew so much. Other than that, I would say the most like kind of pinnacle part of this course is you do have like a 17 mile climb.
Mm.
Not to say that it's 70 miles of hiking. It was for me because of the state my body was in, but it's just like it's net up for 17 miles and you just have to like grit your teeth and get through it. And then the dirt road coming down is pretty big. If you have legs to run, then you have like a really big, strong, fast 6 mile finish.
Mm-hmm.
I walked it and walked backwards down it for 6 miles, like 2.5 hours for me.
Well, let's talk about that. So you have a strong start, you're feeling good, but then your feet eat you up. So break that down, describe what happened and what that was like.
Mile 10, I felt both of my toes on the exact same spot. I was wearing shoes that I had not like trained in,
mm-hmm.
and they just start rubbing. And to this day, you actually see it in the doc. Kristen says, I'm describing my blisters coming in at mile 14. And she says, do you want to change your shoes? And I don't answer her.
Yeah, I heard her say that.
I just keep talking. It's like,
you're
even
like stupid.
I'm like literally like resisting, like smacking my face mm-hmm. right now on this podcast. I don't change them. And here's why. Everything other than the blisters, everything about that shoe felt perfect for me. It was so cushioned. I loved the way that it just felt on my foot. And for some reason, I had this ironic this thought process that makes no sense to this day, that if I like bandaged the blisters, they wouldn't get worse. Like, come on, Ray, you have 80 plus miles left. Like, they're going to get worse. So, as I just mentioned, once you leave that aid station at 14, you don't see crew for like 24 miles. And so by that point, I mean, there was no recovering. The skin was just like peeling off of my toes. And my crew did a phenomenal job of not letting me know that what they were seeing on my feet was like a little bit like, oh, how is she going to do this? Mm-hmm. I can remember Kristen calling for my mom, Patty, will you come look at this? But I just didn't think anything of it. I was too distracted. So really the rest of my race, and this is why I like want to go back for redemption so badly, is because it wasn't even about displaying my fitness or, you know, enjoying it. It was, how do I keep these blisters from getting worse? But at the same time, there's no avoidance of the pain, like none. So that's why you see a lot in the dock, I've just like just walking and particularly walking backwards, because I was doing anything to like take the pressure off.
How did you handle mentally? Because I know in the dock, like one of your sisters says, talk yourself out of that loop. And
yeah,
you know, I think that's a big takeaway I had with crewing Joey, was just the emphasis and the consequences, positive consequences of staying positive, even, and just smiling, cracking jokes, even if you're in the absolute, you know, abyss of pain. Yeah. So how did you try and mentally handle that?
The first thing was adjusting my expectations. So like at Run Rabbit, you have the hare category and the tortoise. I did run in the tortoise because A, my first one, B, you don't get pacers in the hare. So it was a no brainer. But in my tortoise division, I was like running in like fourth female for a while. And so as soon as I felt the pain of the blisters coming on and actually noticing that it was slowing me down, then it really just became about adjusting expectations and being like, you know what, Reagan, like you're going to finish a 100-mile race. Mm-hmm. Like, so what if you're coming in at 35 hours and 59 seconds?
You like the Brock approach.
Yeah, there it is.
Yeah.
Like quit competing. And that's really what I did. I was like, I could care less where I was. I could care less. There was still a little bit of a dialogue that was upset that I could not display what I've been working for, because I mean this from the bottom of my heart. I'm not too arrogant to like just make this up. I could have been shuffling from mile 70 to 100. Like, I had the fitness to be running. Mm-hmm. And I literally just couldn't. Like, my feet were bleeding. It was like, I have to do what I have to do.
Yeah.
But like, looking back though, I didn't crack the jokes and have conversation and sing songs.
Mm-hmm.
Kristen might have been doing all of that, but like, we joke about it all the time that I said like 12 words over the course of 30 miles, and it was either I have to go to the bathroom or I need to sleep.
It seems like once the, you know, things get very painful and the sun goes down, the words get very sparse.
Yeah.
And so that was another question I was going to ask, was what was the approach of each pacer? So you had Kristen, you had Jesse. Did you have a third?
No, those two. Yeah.
What was the approach of both of them as far as keeping you distracted, or what did you need from them? Did you wish they maybe approached it differently?
Yeah. No, so I'm actually glad you brought this up, because a really like cool story that you don't necessarily get the exposure to in the documentary is that where Jesse picked me up at mile 43 is actually where Kristen was supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
And so Kristen was going to take me that first section and Jesse was going to take me the last. And I think this is so cool that Kristen is humble enough to recognize that they needed to flop, because I came in close to 4 hours earlier than I had told my crew to expect me at mile 43, because I was moving that well.
Mm.
And so Jesse and I at this point have been training together for weeks. And every time I came back from training with Jesse, I would always talk like out loud, whether it's to my friends or family or Kristen, like, man, we were rolling today. Like, when we run together, we run. Like, we don't jog. Mm. And so Kristen went to Jesse and said, hey, I think you need to pick her up here, because she might drop me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such a humble approach, right? Because like, no one wants to go, someone who's run 43 miles might drop me, right? Like, maybe that hits the pride a little bit, but it doesn't for Kristen, because the way she looked at it was, Jesse needs to come in, and they need to just like, this is a net down yeah. section. They need to just roll.
Well, she just chose what's best for you.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So Jesse was so encouraging. One of the most verbally encouraging people you'll ever meet. She was like, has a little bit of a military background. And so like, if I sat down, she'd be like, Reagan, 2 minutes, get up. Or like, eat your food or... Mm-hmm.
Like a drill sergeant.
Open your eyes. Yeah, yeah, she told me to open my eyes a lot. And not that Kristen didn't do the same, but like Kristen was able to, from mile 70 to 100, kind of had a little bit more of an empathetic approach. And she only told me after that there were multiple times in that section that she actually like teared up, like in just being so proud because she was able to see like how much I was hurting, but just like the willingness that I had yeah. to get through it. And so it was really cool for her to be able to experience that because it was really a really cool full circle moment that she had seen me train for the last 8 months, and now she kind of got to like see all of that 8 months training come to fruition by crossing the finish line.
Yeah, I feel yeah. like when you're choosing your pacers and something I think about, you gotta like choose them wisely for very specific reasons, like yeah. what you might want emotionally at a certain moment. Because yeah. for Joey, when he first came in, I was his first pacer, and I was very driven on, okay, like keep him in good spirits, but we got to keep a pace.
Yeah.
You know, and it was important that I did that because we made up 30 minutes more
That's awesome.
Than he was expecting. And little did we realize at the end, he finished with like 33 minutes to spare. So like we really needed that, you know?
And you probably saw this, but like Joey would not have made those decisions for himself, yeah, right? Like yeah. he probably would not have.
And not just me, Ty as well, I know that. Yeah. But yeah.
But
yeah.
you get him, like it really and truly is so critical. But yeah. it's, but like they, what was kind of funny looking back is like, and this just goes to show how much I trust them, but like they made that decision for me. My plan in my head, the way I'd like envisioned it was the vice versa, right? Mm-hmm. Kristen first, Jesse last. And you see it briefly. It's a short conversation in the dock. I'm coming up the dirt road and I'm like, hey, who's going to pace me? And Kristen goes, it's going to be Jesse. She's best for you right now. Mm-hmm. And it could That's not good. Have gone better.
You need a strong crew to make those right decisions. Yeah. And I know Joey needed that. And I'm sure I'll need it, you know. Yeah. And Bighorn as well.
Yeah.
It's a very personal question for me asking you because I got my own race coming up. How do you mentally compartmentalize a race? You know you're going to be out there for 30 plus hours just chugging along, moving yeah. those feet. How did you try and handle it? And then going into future races, what do you think, you know, helps the yeah. best?
So kind of like we were talking about in the beginning, my like very competitive and strategic approach to these races acts as a distraction for me. So like mile 0 to 40-45 just went by so fast because it's almost like I'm constantly game planning. Like I don't know if you do this in a race, but like if you're looking at someone in front of you and behind you, are you constantly gauging like how close you are to catching them or how close they are to catching you? So like I do that a lot. Like I pretty much do that the whole time, and that's just the competitive spirit. So this is how it worked in my head. I'd never run more than 40 miles, right? But I at least knew what that 40-mile mark felt like and roughly how long it would take. Luckily enough, in Run Rabbit, it was around mile 43 that I got to get a pacer. So the race in my mind was only from mile 0 to mile 40 yeah. because now I get to pick someone up. And it was also at the mile 40 mark that I knew I saw my crew in a lot quicker frequencies. And so 0 to 40, easy, right? 40 to 70 with my pacers, my pacer, with mm-hmm. seeing my crew a lot, easy. Mile 70 to 100, like the depths of hell. I kid you not. Like that, it never felt like the sun was going to come up. And that's miserable. Have you run through the night yet?
Well, I did for pacing.
For pacing,
Joey.
Okay.
Yeah, I spent about 6 hours.
I haven't gotten to pace anyone yet, so I don't know like how that compares. But that was hard. It was so cold, and I was so sleepy. And
it's hard to stay focused when you have the headlights.
So hard to stay focused. Yeah, yeah. And like, I was self conscious about putting my hat on backwards. I don't know why. I was like, I don't want to be a girl with her hat on backwards. But you have to do it because like that headlight
other hits the brim. Yeah,
yeah, and it'll create a dome. But I think like my best advice is, it's not uncommon, everyone says it, but like break it up. Like don't look at it as a 100-mile race. Like look at it, when are you going to see your crew? When do you get your pacers? Maybe when is a pacer coming in to change it up for you? Mm-hmm. I would go into it understanding that the night portion will be the toughest, because as tired as you are and how much you might hurt, the sun coming up is truly like a breath of fresh air. It feels like a new start and a new day. Mm-hmm. And that also, like, chronologically, your brain is telling you that you're that much closer to the finish.
Yeah.
So you're not getting like that adrenaline kick that you get at the finish line, but you do get a little bit of an adrenaline boost in general.
You know, Maddie tells me it's just run faster. And I can't argue with that advice. It would be done a lot quicker.
Something that I appreciate about you is like you so openly own this, like I've heard you call yourself slow so many times, and you're like,
well,
and it's just so unique, because you're like, hey, this is like,
this is me.
First of all, you're not slow. Like, you go out, you run races. You said you're in the middle of a pack. Like, you're not slow.
Well, I think maybe that's why I like ultra running, because I think in a race setting, I can make up some time with my own mental grit or strength on climbs to where maybe I'm not the best runner, but I can eat up some other people in those spots. And I know I'm not crap, but I think I just own it so that it isn't anything that I tick on my own personal pride. I guess maybe it regulates my expectations for myself or something like that.
Okay.
Because
it was like one of the first things you said to me when we did our first trail run together.
Well, the reason I say that is just because I know you and Jess, you're fast, and I'm like, hey, if we run, even we run like a tempo pace for me, you guys are probably gonna be like 130 beats per minute. Like, you're gonna be just hanging around.
Yeah.
And I was like, or like, I can hang with you, but I'm not going to be talking because I'm going to be breathing, you know? So it was more like, hey, I really want to run with you guys, but you're going to have to meet me somewhere.
Yeah.
And it won't be a hard training day when you're in prep for a race kind of thing, because I don't want to take that from you.
And we all have those people, right? Because like Jessie's a faster runner than I am.
Mm-hmm.
We still run together, but it just means that the effort she's putting out is different than the effort I'm putting out. And then you introduced me to D, and so I've been running with D a good bit. And not only is he like 6 inches taller than me, but he's also a guy. He's athletic.
Yeah.
He's good. And like I tell him at the start of every run we've done together, I'm like, you can leave me. We did 16 on Rampart together, just four up, four down, four up,
four down.
Well,
what I tell people is like, hey, I'm your perfect companion for your slow days, because I'll keep you slow. You know, you won't go too far. So
you sound like Kristen. Kristen's the same thing. Y'all got to run together.
We should. We will soon. So you finished 100, and I'm curious what's next for you after that. So you mentioned you want to go back to that race.
Mm-hmm.
I know we just had a lottery recently. It seems like no one in our little group chat got into Leadville. But what are some, it could be beyond this year, like what are some boxes you want to check off in the next coming years? I know you kind of describe you have this ultra running career set up to be a long-term thing, and you reference 200-mile races. Like, do those pull at your heartstrings, or what do you
not
have in your mindset?
Not the slightest right now.
Me neither. I like my sleep.
Yeah. No, 200, just like, I know that they're out there running, Sally McRae being an obvious example, but it just doesn't feel like a race to me.
I've talked to that about a lot of people. I think it's like a different thing.
Yeah.
You know? Kind of like ultra races and road races that are like 10Ks or half.
Yeah.
It's like a different sport.
For sure.
It's the same activity, but how you approach it, like you said, you're not, like, how much are you really running 90 hours? It's very sporadic.
To me, and I could be so, like, I feel like I'm, you know, kind of talking out of my own, out of my place here, but it's like, who can sleep the least?
Yeah.
Who can manage to keep eating?
Walk the fastest.
Who can walk the fastest?
Yeah.
So it
doesn't
interest
me. It's a war of attrition
me.
Even more than a regular ultra.
And I mean, hear me out. 4 years ago is when I said those words that I'll never run more than 4 miles. So like, we could come back together 3 years from now and maybe I've done one. But like right now, no. What I really made this year about is trying to get faster. So choosing races that A, are going to attract some competitive runners, some faster runners that I can just be in the pack with. So Black Canyon 60K is coming up on February 11th.
That's right, yeah.
That's that, like, notoriously fast kind of, like, net down race. I'm waitlisted for the Gorge 100K in Oregon. Not necessarily a fast race. There's a good bit of climbing in it, but it's known as a more competitive race.
Mm-hmm.
I signed up for Leadville Marathon as, like, a fun summer, like, shorter distance. And then Run Rabbit in September. And then my coach really wants me to look into the Hellgate 100K in December. That one's interesting because you can't just sign up for it. You have to apply, and the race director chooses. Yeah.
Oh, so it's kind of like Laz has his weird
Yeah.
prerequisites. What are, is there any criteria for why they choose or what? No, it's kind of random.
Right. Which is like kind of weird, but kind of makes it fun, but also feels unfair. Not unfair, that's the wrong word, but it's like the, so the applications word haven't
even come out yet. Well, it's not fair, but I think, I don't always think in certain circumstances, I don't think fairness has to be the utmost virtue in every scenario.
I don't think so either. So, I'm not, trust me, we could, that could be a whole other tangent for a different podcast.
Yeah.
If we base everything around fairness, this world would be more corrupt than maybe it is right now. So
yeah, the subjective thing is kind of neat.
I kind of like it. It's different. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyways, that's kind of what things are looking like. I might sprinkle, I love the half marathon distance. Mm-hmm. Like, I just love that. So I might throw a couple of those in, but really it's just about trying to get faster, trying to get better turnover, and trying to pick races that, you know, are going to bring people in. I don't really ever want to go run Leadville. I don't know why. It doesn't call to me. I think it's because it's becoming so commercialized and so influencer-ish. And
yeah. Like, you know, why don't we finish rambling on that? People have to wait for this rant or they'll skip the time code. But yeah, Leadville, it has... Gosh, a couple of the sports have, but specifically Leadville, has become so influencer or brand focused that it is off-putting when you look, and it used to be lottery, or maybe they had the foundations for it, but it was lottery or qualify, and it was like very strict on how you get in. Now, I'm like, oh, you got in with Koros, and you got in with so-and-so brand, and you're in with Goo, and it's like, you know, they end up bringing all these people that maybe they're not even like runners, but they have big followings, and they bring them in, and speaking of fairness, it feels unfair to the people that this is their kind of everything, and this is like something that's very valued to them. It's like they're getting preferential treatment just because they have some big social following, which is understandable commercially, but as the race itself is organized, it feels
wrong. And here's the other thing. Something that bothers me is calling it a lottery when it is very obvious that races are not a lottery. So if Leadville was a lottery, then why are they asking you all those questions when you're signing up for the lottery, okay? There is absolutely no reason you need to know that. You need the name and age and credit card information.
Yeah.
And then you could even spin the ball like Western States does on live camera.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got Leadville, you've even got Hard Rock.
Yeah,
now are like, and people are nicknaming it the Leadville and Hard Rock Selection instead of. So that's kind of like, I don't know. It doesn't call to me. If there's a 100 out there that's considered one of the big ones that calls to me out of all of them, it would be Western States.
Yeah.
Because of the course, because of the history of it, because of the organic nature of it, that I truly do believe it is a lottery, with the exception of qualifying, right? I think that's another cool part of it, is like you can actually go and qualify for that. Right? You could make your whole year about only running Western States qualified races to get in. So that's another cool competitive outlet of it.
Yeah. Well, I feel like we touched on everything. Maybe we'll have to do it again after I've run my race and you run more of yours.
Yeah.
But where can people find you, Reagan?
Instagram primarily. So at Reagan Sykes.
Exactly how it's spelled out?
Okay, I honestly always forget if it's Reagan Sykes 5 or Reagan Sykes.
Either way, it'll be in the show notes. Yeah. And it'll be hard to miss you. How
yeah,
about that?
Okay.
I doubt there's many Reagan Sykes that are running like you are. So
it's Reagan Sykes. Yeah. So Reagan Sykes, my documentary.
I was gonna say, shout out the dog.
So Christopher, it's on his YouTube as Christopher Gabayan. And I want to take a second to say, like, I want to push that documentary for him even way more than me. He's one of the most incredible humans I've ever met, but he's exiting the military to make this his full-time gig, his full-time business, like, so film and photography. And so I was lucky enough to have him come on, and it's like it's an awesome thing for me to have for the rest of my life. But if anything, I wanted this to help him. I wanted it to kind of act as a launching pad, really.
Yeah.
So I want to put that out here for people to go watch it, comment, share it. And yeah, Instagram. I think all my Instagram feeds to Facebook, but I don't really intentionally market that one. So.
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah.
Well, if you guys enjoyed the podcast, obviously give it a share, follow Reagan, and subscribe to the show for more content like this. We'll catch you guys in the next one.